show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
Begin countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show. America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Guy James Show, coming to you live from the beautiful sandy beaches and blue waters of beautiful Southwest Florida, all around the country, and yes, all around the world on the internet. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. We hope to have an interesting show for you today. We are going to have Glenn Greenwald with us at the bottom of this hour from Salon Magazine to talk about this military analyst story that the networks are continuing to ignore. And then in the second hour, at the bottom of the second hour, we're going to have Helen Thomas along with us, our beloved Helen Thomas, and she'll have something to say about the well, the way the White House has covered up the torture and completely, Perino has completely ignored it and refuses to answer any questions about it and so forth. So we'll, hopefully everything will go right and we'll have both of those folks on with us today. A lot going on. It is primary day in North Carolina and Indiana, the Hoosier State and North Carolina. And, I'm not going to talk a lot about that today because the big news will be tonight and tomorrow. Anything I would have to tell you, almost anything I would have to tell you about it today would just be pretty much a rehash of what the networks are blabbing on and on and on about right now, what each poll says and how they think it's going to turn out. You know, the big winner in all this has been the media, the electronic media especially. More ratings, sell more ads. They've made a lot of money off of this campaign, and lest you think that they're interested in seeing it end, they are not. They would like to see it go right on to the convention and see McCain Hillary and Obama slug it out right up until then. That means more ratings, more dollars in their pockets. So don't let them confuse you by saying, oh, gee, this needs to come to an end. They don't mean it. They don't want it to come to an end. And however it comes out, I don't care. I want it to end the right way, no matter how it is. If they go to the convention, fine. If they settle it there, if they have a floor fight, fine. It'll be settled one way or another, and hopefully it'll be fair, and hopefully we'll have the right candidate. And as I've mentioned many, many times, whichever candidate of ours ends up as the nominee for the Democratic Party will end up in the White House. Of that, I am supremely confident. I don't have a whole lot of doubt about that. Just some odds and ends that I want to talk about today. You know, somebody sent me a picture of John McCain, John Sidney McCain. And I noticed that in this picture, and it was one of these joke things that goes around, and I noticed on this picture that John McCain was not wearing a lapel pin of a flag. And, of course, as you well know, I consider anybody who doesn't wear a lapel pin, a flag lapel pin, to be a dirty, no-good, pinko, commie, anti-American seditionist. you must be if you don't wear a lapel pin, of course. And I started looking across the net for pictures of John McCain, and I ran across six or seven pictures of him, and not in one picture was he wearing a flag lapel pin. Now, how can this man seriously be considered for the White House if he doesn't wear a lapel pin? We all know that that's a big deal in the media, and I've not heard anybody mention it. Now, maybe you can find a picture of him with a lapel pin, but I could not. So, if Barack Obama is a nasty boy for not wearing a lapel pin, and was supposed to explain himself and didn't adequately explain himself to the masses with Georgie Stephanopoulos and whoever the hell else that was in that debate, I don't even remember, then surely John McCain's got some explaining to do. Every candidate should have a lapel pin, a flag lapel pin on his suit, on his jogging suit, on his jammies. They should wear them all the time. They should have a little flag thingies painted on their shoes. They should even have them maybe on the side of their glasses. They should have pins everywhere with the flag on them. Otherwise, I don't think they're qualified to be president of the United States. Just an observation today for me. Okay, I'm having one of those weird days. Want to say happy birthday to a friend of mine up in Ohio. I won't embarrass him by giving his name, Damon. But he's one of those things you always want to look out on your birthday. You know, birthdays can be tough for people sometimes. They have horrible things happen to them on their birthday. That's an inside joke, and I guess they'll get that. Chrysler doing an oddball thing. They're coming out with some sort of a program, and I didn't have a lot of time to read about it, but some sort of a program. If you buy a vehicle from them, they're going to give you a gas card that guarantees that you'll be able to buy gas for only $2.99 a gallon. That gives you some idea as to how what big business seems to know the inside track on what's going to happen to gas prices. Ergo, if you think gas is going to go down below $2.99 a gallon, I guess, as they say, you got another think a coming, because it's not going to. Whew. Man, I hate to think of that. So Chrysler, if you buy a car, they're going to give you this gas card, and it'll guarantee that you can buy gas for only $2.99 a gallon for 3 years at whatever the gas usage of that vehicle happens to be for 12,000 miles is rated by the EPA. And what it amounts to, let's say a car gets 25 miles to the gallon, something like, it's going to be about a grand over 3 years, the way I figured. It's somewhere around $1,000 it'll save you on gas. So that's what big business thinks is going to happen to gas. You don't think Chrysler's going to gamble too much, do you? So anyway... get yourself a new Chrysler product and save a buck or two on gas. And I see some grocery stores are doing things about gas. My brother lives out in Phoenix, and I understand some of the grocery stores over in Eastern Ohio are doing this as well. That if you buy $50 worth of groceries, you get 10 or 20 cents a gallon off of your next tank of gas. So we've got to be resourceful. Business has got to be resourceful. Find ways to help their customers out, and we will help them out. Of course, the price of groceries nowadays, $50 worth of groceries goes in one of those small bags. Wow. I was in the store the other day. I think, what is it, the 32-ounce size of Miracle Whip. I like Miracle Whip. I'm more of a Miracle Whip guy than I am a mayonnaise guy. I like mayonnaise, but I really like Miracle Whip, and I don't like that Miracle Whip light either. I don't know. Most of that light stuff doesn't taste good to me. Why the hell am I talking about this? Anyway, I noticed the 32-ounce jar of Miracle Whip was on sale at my local grocery store for only $4.39. I know for a fact that jar of Miracle Whip last year at this time was $2.69. I buy a lot of Miracle Whip. Just imagine that. And Swiss cheese I saw the other day. Baby Swiss, $9.69 a pound. Roast beef, $9.99 a pound. Whoa. Even bologna. Beef bologna is around $4 a pound. I don't know how it is where you live, but... Okay, I'm seeing where that's Giant Eagle and Shop and Save and Foodland in Pittsburgh. Giant Eagle, for one thing. I used to do some consulting work for them probably many years ago. One of the best grocery chains in America, to my way of thinking. And they're one of them giving some of the discounts on gas. Excellent. Craziest quote in history. Craziest quote in history, okay? Dick Cheney. And let me quote him. He said, when the history is written, it'll be said that we lived in a safer country and a more hopeful world. I'm sorry. It's one of these things that just elicits a laugh or two. Let me start over. The craziest quote ever. And when the history is written, I'm quoting Dick Darth Cheney right now. When the history is written, it'll be said that we lived in a safer country and a more hopeful world because George Bush was president of these United States. Dick Cheney said on May 2nd, 2008. Thank you, Dick. Thank you for those words of wisdom. Man, that's just awe-inspiring. I want to cry when I hear that. I really do. And I see that the oil companies, now they're starting to give one excuse, two excuses, three excuses, four. For one of the reasons that the price of their oil is going up, they're for example, having trouble finding experienced workers. Yes, they're part of the high price of oil is because of the lack of experienced workers on their exploration crews, for example. And, oh man, that reminds me of a story. You talk about getting sidetracked today. I'm off on one tangent after another. Part of the high price of oil, because they can't get experienced workers. I must confess that when I was in college one summer, I lived in Ohio, and a lot of you may or may not know this, but there's lived in one of those areas pretty close to where I had what we called the oil boom in Ohio, okay? Yes, actually drilled a bunch of oil wells in Ohio at that time. That's back in the last century. Anyway, they were drilling, and I applied for a job, a summer job with this company. It was called the Purcell Exploration Company, and they were out of Lufkin, Texas. And so here was this Yankee boy, Yankee college boy, working with all these cowboy, old boys from Lufkin, Texas. And on this Purcell Exploration Company vehicle, it was a seismograph crew is what it was. We had the seismograph truck that was kind of like a camper-like thing. It had all the delicate instruments in to measure the sound waves underground. And then we would drill a hole about 100 feet deep, I don't know, maybe 5 inches across. We'd come in and drill a hole about 5 inches across, and you'd put these sticks of dynamite on a stick and lower it down in, and then we'd set off the charge, and then the seismograph machine would register the sound waves, and they'd be able to tell one way or another if there was, you know, likelihood of oil being under the ground. So it was my job to strap these dynamite sticks, and I'd been a farm boy. I'd used dynamite sticks before, blowing stumps and stuff. And so it was my job to strap the dynamite on the stick and lower it down into the hole. And then the seismograph truck would be, 50 yards away or all, and we'd blow the stick of dynamite, and boom. And so we were doing that, and I'd work with them, I don't know, a month, 5, 6 weeks, whatever it happened to be. And the Texas boys went to lunch. They went into the nearest town to get themselves some lunch. So my Yankee college boyfriend and I, Larry, we thought it'd be a lot of fun to see just how many sticks of dynamite we could lower into one of those 100-foot holes. We had a hole dug, and we were going to blow it after lunch. And so tied, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 sticks of dynamite to one of these sticks and lowered it into the hole. And we got back and we set it off. And the problem was we were doing fine, but one of the boys Texas Boys pickup truck was still there. They all jumped in one truck and went into town. And what happened was they left one of the trucks not too far from that hole. And we blew the door off the pickup truck by putting too much dynamite in the hole while these boys were at lunch. And when they came back and saw the door blown off the pickup truck laying, I don't know, several feet away, they weren't real pleased. And they didn't even say anything to us. They didn't say a word. They just pointed toward town. And we got the message that we were to leave and get out of there. And we never did get our last paycheck. So that's my story. I'm sticking to it. That's my oil exploration story. But anyway, what I was getting at here, I wanted to talk about this windfall profit tax that's being discussed. And I think it's a good idea. But the oil companies are naturally saying, oh, no, we can't do that because we won't be able to invest as much in exploration as we do now if we have to pay all this money out. We're putting a lot of money back, and we're exploring for oil, and all this costs money, so you can't put a windfall tax on us because we're spending all of that big profit that we're making. That's pure old American BS, big pile of it, okay? The five big oil companies have been spending plenty on buybacks, but damn little on exploration. And from 2003 to 2006, they've only, which you all know, their profits have increased massively and even more since then. They've only increased their exploration budget from $6 billion to $10 billion. That's the five biggest oil companies added together. Compare that to their profits. So don't believe that they can't afford the exploration if they have a windfall profits tax. And I think that the windfall profits tax is one of the best things that we could possibly do for the good of the nation. And as I've said before, I also believe that maybe starting to think about nationalizing our country's largest oil company might be a good move as well. Go ahead and scream and throw rocks if you want to, but I think it'd be a damn good idea for the good of the people of the United States. We've already had Junior Bush, McCain. I think of Junior Bush. McCain, I think of Junior Bush. It's a Freudian slip. But we've already had McCain out there. I almost said it again. We've had McCain out there saying, you know, we don't want to go to war anymore for oil, basically what he said. And then he tried to backpedal. Oh, no, that's not what I meant. And he was caught. He knows deep in his heart. He knows damn well why we went to war in Iraq. He knows. There were two reasons, really. One was a macho reason, that Junior wanted to get rid of the nasty man who threatened his daddy. And probably the second, maybe most important, was to get their oil. Period. To enrich Bush and his friends and everybody in that upper echelon of, their pals. But Hillary and McCain coming up with this gas tax vote gimmick, I don't know how you feel about it. But, I don't know, I figured it up for me, it amounts to about $30 between Memorial Day and Labor Day this year, and it's not a big deal. First of all, could they even get that done by Memorial Day? I say no, probably not. Secondly, neither one of them is the president. Why are they talking as though they were the president and they were gonna knock off this 18.4 cents a gallon of federal gasoline tax when neither of them can do a damn thing about it except go talk to their friends and try and talk them into it? Neither of them are president, and they can't do anything about this. And yet they're out telling the public that, well, you know, if I will do this, well, they can't. They can't do it. They'd have to get this bill through Congress and get Junior Bush to sign it by May 26th, and neither of them has the power to do that. But, and as you know, I want to see Hillary Clinton get the nomination, but this is pure old-fashioned politicking pandering. That's what it is. And they all do some of it. But let's get real here. This is just another political gimmick to get the uneducated, the uninformed, the political neophytes, the political people, the people who have their heads in the sand, get them to vote for them. You know, the if we really want to do something about the price of gasoline, price of heating oil and diesel fuel and all of that, I've got a real idea. Now, Hillary and McCain can come up with what they want to, but I've got a really good idea to do something about that. It's the only thing we talk about anymore. So I think what we ought to do is we ought to get a presidential candidate and a vice presidential candidate, a couple of them that got big ties to the oil industry, okay? Real oil insiders. Somebody that really knows the business, somebody who's been involved in the business, got friends in the business, worked in the business. A couple of people like that and know how these things work. And then if we elected a couple of people like that, we'd probably get the price, you know, maybe know the Saudis as well. We elect a couple of people like that, maybe we'll get the price of oil down where it needs to be. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, yeah, I forgot. Been there, done that. Been there, done that. Well, I was just saying. 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254 if you'd like to join us here on the program. I see the Republicans are talking about maybe having Bobby Jindal, the new governor of Louisiana. Now, he's been governor, what, how many months? Not very long. He's 36 years old. And they want to maybe put him up as a vice presidential candidate. Let's see. Okay, maybe get the Southerners to go along with him, and maybe get the people, some of the ethnic people to go along with him by putting up Bobby Jindal. 36 years old. Well, I don't know. I don't know about a 36-year-old being vice president of the United States. I know when I was 36, they wouldn't have wanted me to be vice president of the United States. No, certainly not. At 36, in most cases, I'm sure Jindal is probably an exception, but I would say in most cases, that's not enough experience. That's what I would say. And, of course, we see that Rush Limbaugh is carrying on his idiotic campaign chaos, and this is an open primary in Indiana, so anybody can go vote, and Limbaugh is claiming that he's going to send all the Republicans out to vote for Hillary today and, you know, affect the Democratic primary. You know, this is disgusting that this man would do this drug junkie. It's more disgusting to me, even more disgusting, is the fact that millions of people listen to a confirmed, admitted brain-addled drug junkie every day who riddled his brain, his head so much with drugs that he actually lost his hearing, and he knew he was losing his hearing and still pumped himself full of illegal drugs, prescription drugs that he didn't have prescription for, that he didn't have the courage to go out and buy himself and send his maid out to Denny's parking lot to buy illegally. This man, who was held in high esteem by so many on the right, this man, one of their heroes, called for everybody who ever used illegal prescription drugs and drugs to be thrown, have their asses thrown in prison and have the key thrown away. Gee, he felt differently afterwards, didn't he? I mean, we all know that story, but every time it rankles me, every time I hear the story about somebody taking Rush Limbaugh seriously about anything, I think, who the hell would listen to Rush Limbaugh in the first place and take anything he says seriously? When he's criticized within the Republican Party, they all say, "Oh, well, you know, he's an entertainer. He's just an entertainer." And when they want him taken seriously, they say, "Well, you know, he's a wise sage of politics, that Rush Limbaugh." Yeah, he sure is. Quite a guy. I heard him say over the weekend that Bill Clinton tried to steal his date. Yes, it did. And he called the mayor of Los Angeles, what was it, a shoeshine boy? Yeah, that's what it was. He likened the mayor of Los Angeles, California, a man of Hispanic descent, as thought he maybe he was the shoeshine boy. Yes, Rush Limbaugh said that over the weekend, that Bill Clinton was trying to steal his date in New York City. First of all, who goes out with Rush Limbaugh? You have to wonder about, you have to wonder about that one. Yes, indeed. You got to wonder about who goes out with Rush Limbaugh. Uh-huh. I don't want to say anything about how his most recent ex-wife looked, but never mind. I won't get into that. 866-546-5254. We're going to pause for a break. Probably get a hold of our guest coming up this afternoon. And we'll be back in just a minute or two.
President Bush has talked about our staying in Iraq for 50 years.
Maybe 100. That'd be fine with me.
President Bush has talked about our staying in Iraq for 50 years.
Maybe 100.
If all he offers is more of the same, is John McCain the right choice for America's future? The Democratic National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
Oh, it's true. It's true.
Call Guy James now. 1-866-546-5254.
Ah, yes, nothing like live radio. Seems like we had an open mic all the while. I was calling my friend Glenn Greenwald. Glenn, welcome to the program.
Hey, great thanks to be here.
You're a good bit away from where we are right now. You're in South America, right?
I am in Brazil, exactly.
Oh, in Brazil, okay. And, well, you're just, so I get this straight, you're heading into winter there now pretty soon?
Yeah, our summers are the winters in the U.S. And vice versa, since we're on the other side of the equator.
Well, you don't get a whole lot of snow there, right?
Basically none.
Well, good. Glenn, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. I read with great interest early last week, I guess it was, your article about this military analyst story that you had in Salon magazine, and as it turns out, it's something that's still almost unknown to anybody that's not a reader of Salon magazine. The networks have refused to comment on it. In fact, I think to this day, nobody except PBS has commented on it at all. Is that still the case?
It is. I mean, of course, the story was, you know, first revealed. Well, I really shouldn't say revealed because it's been discussed for years, but it was first kind of triggered, the most recent round, by a very lengthy front page expose in the New York Times about 3 weeks ago that really implicates, you know, the core integrity of the network news and cable news shows and newspapers across the country in terms of how they were reporting on the war. And you're absolutely right. Not a single one of them, other than PBS, and a couple of very brief mentions on CNN, have even acknowledged the story at all, even told their readers about it, let alone examined it or responded to the allegations.
And your emphasis in your story was not so much on the military analysts themselves and the depravity, what I think is the depravity and deceitfulness of the Pentagon doing this. Your article is more or less damning the media for the way they've handled it.
Well, that's right. I mean, as I indicated, I mean, the New York Times story a couple of weeks ago revealed some new details, but the fundamentals have been long known, and that means that these retired generals have been doing nothing but spewing a very pro-government, pro-war view, and yet they were put onto these networks, virtually all of them, without opposition, presented as objective analysts, so that viewers of most American media shows heard nothing but a pro-war viewpoint. And in fact, there were specific concerns raised about their independence and objectivity, even by the New York Times back in 2003 that ran a general kind of piece, whether retired generals who obviously have close connections to the Pentagon, even after they're retired, could possibly really be objective. And then there was a specific piece in The Nation in April of 2003 that specified two different NBC analysts, two retired generals, and raised concerns that both of them had elaborate ties to the defense industry that basically gave them ample motive to talk up the war and even to recommend that the war be intensified, obviously negating their ability to be objective analysts. And The Nation even told NBC News about it and were basically dismissed and ignored. So the networks have known about these problems for years, and yet they continue to use these analysts without any concern for those questions.
Now, Howard Kurtz is saying that he thinks it's because they're embarrassed about it. Don't you think it goes a bit deeper than that?
Oh, I do. I mean, I think they are embarrassed about it, but I think far more than embarrassed, I mean, they stand exposed as basically being in league with the Bush administration and complicit in disseminating a domestic propaganda campaign designed to mislead Americans into believing they were getting objective analysis when they were basically getting the coordinated government line. I mean, it's very serious wrongdoing on the part of the network. There are felonies that are more likely committed if there was a domestic propaganda campaign coordinated by the Pentagon. And for the networks to be involved in that knowingly is an obviously very serious matter that they're essentially just concealing and suppressing by refusing to address the issue or tell their viewers about it.
So you think it's not reporting laziness. You just think it's a willingness to go along with them for what reason, to go along with the administration on this?
Well, if you look back at 2003 and all the things that were happening, I mean, you look at, for example, the way that MSNBC canceled the Phil Donahue show, even though it had among its best the best ratings of any MSNBC show, and the way that Ashley Banfield, who for a time was one of the top MSNBC stars, she was fired after she gave a speech criticizing the coverage of the Iraq War by the American media. What you see is a really consistent pattern of these networks and the corporations that own them and the corporations that advertise in them really basically taking a position that no anti-war position could be heard or that the pro-war position had to predominate. Now, whether that was for business reasons or for ideological reasons or because there was just too much cultural and political pressure on them to do anything but toe the line, I think it's a mixture of all of those things, but whatever the reasons were, what clearly happened was that our major media outlets decided to essentially amplify the government position and uncritically disseminate it, and basically concealed and suppressed anything that was anti-war. And then one of the ways they did that was by putting these retired generals on to pretend that they were objective analysts when all they were there to do was to basically propagandize the American public into supporting the war.
Do you think it's a lot of it's basically just kissing up so that they can keep good access to the White House and to the Pentagon?
That's definitely part of it. I mean, of course, you know, the principal way that our media works is what a good media would do is to be adversarial to political power and to fulfill the vision of the founders, which was to serve as a watchdog over the political class. Our media does the opposite. They curry favor with power. They are essentially assimilated into the political class, in part, as you say, in order to ensure that they get access. When they please politically powerful people, they get exclusives and leaks and access. So certainly a big part of it was that they wanted to keep their access. But a bigger part of it was that they really became part of the government mission in Iraq. I mean, their reporters were embedded in the military. They were reliant upon the military for their safety and for their information. They were constantly meeting with government officials. They were vetting their own sources through the Pentagon. Eason Jordan, who's a former CNN executive at the time, said that he went to the Pentagon and got the approval for every one of the military sources that CNN used, and that was important to them. So they really became part of the government team, part of the effort to sell the war to the American public. And when they did that, they lost all objectivity.
Now, as I understand it, you personally had a hand in starting a firestorm, as it were, on Brian Williams' blog. Yeah, you want to tell us about that?
Sure. I mean, he has a blog. I don't know if very many people are aware of it, but he does have a blog, and he seems to write his own entries. And I had written about the fact that none of the networks, including NBC, where Brian Williams broadcast as the anchor, had even mentioned or acknowledged the New York Times story on the military analyst scandal. And yet, on his blog, about a week after, 10 days after the New York Times article was first published, Brian Williams wrote something where he basically mocked and ridiculed the New York Times by going through 7 or 8 stories from their Sunday edition that he considered to be frivolous and kind of ridiculed each story independently, one by one, and said, I don't know what the New York Times thinks they're doing or who their target readership is, but this is all very frivolous. And it was just unbelievable that, you know, there had been a major front page expose in the same Sunday Times that called into question the core objectivity of his network news that he had completely ignored and said nothing about. And yet there he was finding the time on his own blog to mock and ridicule, you know, 7 or 8 very irrelevant kind of cultural fluff pieces in the New York Times. And he actually, interestingly enough, in that same post said, by contrast, however, in contrast to what he thought was the bad journalism of the New York Times, I want to recommend this Peggy Noonan column, which was an attack that Peggy Noonan wrote on Barack Obama for failing to wear a lapel pin and things like that. And he said, I actually think she's in the running for a Pulitzer Prize. And so here he is ignoring a major expose that shows that the network news outlets of our country are in cahoots with the government to propagandize the public, ignoring that, but saying that Peggy Noonan deserves a Pulitzer for some very cliched attack on Barack Obama for failing to wear a lapel pin. So I wrote about that amazing contrast. And as a result, huge numbers of people went to his blog and angrily demanded in his comment section to know why he had ignored the New York Times story. And the next day he responded, and he basically said, yes, you're right, I haven't responded to the New York Times story, but as far as the generals that I've worked with, all I can tell you is that they're honorable, patriotic men, and I don't believe they did anything wrong. And of course, as I indicated, two of the generals that he specifically identified as having worked with and vouching for were ones the Nation 4 years ago, Nation Magazine, had specifically proven had all kinds of ties to the defense industry and sat on the boards of all kinds of corporations that incentivized them to advocate for the war. And on NBC News, that's exactly what they did.
Are you referring to Wayne Downing, who I think who's passed on now, and Barry McCafferty? Are those the two?
Precisely. Those are the two that Brian Williams specifically said he could personally vouch for as being objective and not touting the government line. And yet I went and read, you know, virtually every broadcast that they appeared on throughout 2003, and all they ever did was cheer for the war, say how necessary the war was. And in fact, both of them were involved in a very far-right group that formed in 2002, the specific purpose of which was to propagandize the public to support an invasion of Iraq. And yet, Brian Williams had both of those generals on many, many times to talk about the war and never once told the NBC viewers that they were involved in that neoconservative group, that they were cheerleaders for the war, or that they had multiple ties to the defense industry that made them stand to gain great profit if the war went forward. Never once did he mention any of that.
And this group you're talking about, is that this Committee for the Liberation of Iraq?
Right. It was formed in 2002. That was the name of it. It was formed with a 25-member board of advisors that included all, you know, the standard neoconservative war supporters like Bill Kristol and Richard Perle, and members of the New Republic, you know, standard neoconservative pro-war theorists and ideologues who were anything but independent. I mean, these are people agitating for an invasion of Iraq in 2002, and there were two of them, retired generals, who were on that board, obviously in favor of the war, being held out by NBC News as objective analysts, both before the invasion and after, supposedly to provide objective commentary to NBC viewers, and they were anything but.
Had Brian Williams done his homework and knew they were part of that? I mean, Newt Gingrich was in that. Elliot Cohen was in it. I'm trying to think who else. Richard Perle, and I think you mentioned Bill Kristol. Anybody involved in the news media would have known who else was in this group and known that you couldn't possibly be independent in your attitude toward the war if you were in that group. And yet, he went right on with them.
I think is just so extreme, you know, is that on the one hand you have this New York Times story that generally called into question the whole practice of using military analysts, but then you move beyond that and you specifically look at the analysts that NBC used, who were among the least independent possible, both politically because of their membership in this far-right group, and financially because they were sitting on the boards of so many corporations that stood to benefit immensely from an invasion, and not only from an invasion, but from an increased ground offensive, which both of those generals advocated. And at the very least, you know, and for NBC not to tell its viewers about that is a major, major journalistic scandal, especially since, as I indicated, the Nation did an expose documenting all those ties, and they even called NBC and told NBC about it and asked them about it, and NBC basically told them, we're not interested in what you have to say, and they continue to use these retired generals, continue to deceive their viewers, and concealed their various ties to the defense industry and this ideological group. It's a real scandal, but of course they control most of the airwaves, and if they conceal or suppress the story, it's very hard to have it be publicized.
It wouldn't be any different than somebody else on the right writing an article in a magazine defending, defending Scooter Libby to the hilt, and then not acknowledging that it was Scooter and he were college buddies and best friends. It's every bit as egregious as that, and yet we have the NBC trying to come off as credible in this whole thing. Do you think it damages their reputation in the long run? Do they recognize that it does, or does it damage their reputation in any meaningful manner?
Well, I think, you know, for a long time, obviously, the network news organizations owned and monopolized the public discourse. And if they didn't report something, it just didn't get reported. And I think, you know, all of that's changing now as a result of alternative political outlets, including things like the internet and blogs, where I've had the opportunity to write, and talk radio shows, the one we're on right now. And, you know, what you see, and all polls show this, are that Americans are reaching the conclusion that our major media institutions are corrupt and unreliable and untrustworthy, and they're starting to seek out alternatives as their of political news and information. And that's happening more and more, and I think as that happens more and more, the major media organizations increasingly lose the ability to control the public discourse. And I think one of the best examples of that was the way that there was a very rapid and intense backlash against ABC News for the way that they moderated the Democratic debate. That was almost generated online and talk radio and elsewhere. And they felt it, and they had to defend themselves, and they took a big hit on their credit. I don't think that would have happened, you know, 10 years ago when they were the only game in town.
Well, the blogosphere and the internet is having an effect. I don't think there's any question about it. And it's great that people can go to the internet and read your articles now on Salon and Joan and everybody over at Salon. You do a great job, and we you got any books coming up, Glenn, in the near future?
Actually, my third book was just released about 3 weeks ago, and it's called Great American Hypocrite. So I'll have to get my publicist send you a copy, and I'd love to come back on and we can discuss it. But yeah, my third book just came out. It's about the themes that the Republican Party uses and the right wing uses to win elections, and the way in which the media assists and aids in that process.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I would love to have you back on and talk about that. You, Glenn and I first met, I think it was at a Take Back America conference several years ago in down at the Washington Hilton, I think it was, anyway.
Yeah,
they had it early this year, so you were probably in South America at the time. You weren't there this year, were you?
I didn't make it there, no.
Okay. Well, Glenn, I want to thank you very much for being on the program. It's a great article. I encourage everybody to go to Salon Magazine and read this. It's a good piece, and it comes at it from a different angle than you've been hearing. Everybody's been talking about just the military people themselves, but it's the media that we really need to hound over this, and it's the media we need to have information about, and Glenn's done a great job in opening that can of worms and exposing it to everybody. Glenn Greenwald, thank you so much for being on the program. I appreciate it, and I hope to talk to you again very soon.
We love that. Great to be here. Thanks very much.
Yeah. That's Glenn Greenwald of Salon Magazine. They do a great job over there. Joan Walsh, friend of the show, the editor. I guess she's the editor-in-chief over Salon. I don't know these people's title altogether, but very accommodating, always good to talk to. If you need to get the skinny on something in Washington that you're not quite sure of, you can always call one of those two and find out. Yeah, Glenn's in Brazil right now. He spends part of his year there. Oh, yeah. Nice, huh? 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. What do we got here? I think we're going to pause for a quick break, and we'll be back in just a minute or two.
You have stuck with the surge and stuck with your position on the surge in Iraq from the beginning. And as you probably know, one of the most viewed videos now on YouTube is the video of you saying, interjecting when someone talks about being in Iraq for 50 years, and you say, could be 100 years. Explain that.
Could be 1,000. Could be 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years.
John McCain has done more than just embrace George Bush's failed policy in Iraq. It's actually his idea to escalate the war there. It's John McCain's idea to send tens of thousands more soldiers to Iraq and to keep them there with no timeline for bringing them home. The McCain plan to escalate, going from bad to worse.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Thanks for lending an ear.
You betcha, right here on the Head On Radio Network, along with Bob Kincaid, John Fox, Mark Levine, and, of course, Billy Shears. Great group on here. Peter Godbo. Great group. And proud to be a part of the Head On Radio Network. I listened to part of Bob's show last night. It was great. Just great. Bob always does a good job. Bob gets a little passionate down then, don't you think? I thought he was going to blow a gasket. Myself, I'm always very calm and collected, and don't reach that level of passion that Bob does. I am always always calm and collected and all that. Hey, I want to read you a letter I got from a listener that I'm proud to have gotten this letter, and I agree with him naturally. And this is from Chuck Roberts out in San Marcos, California. And Chuck said I could go ahead and use his name and use this letter on the show, and I'm happy to do so. He said, Guy, I heard your show yesterday. He was talking about last Thursday's show. He said, I couldn't agree more on John McCain not being a hero. The term has been dumbed down in recent years to include anyone that serves in the military. The proper term, in my opinion, for those that chose to serve their country... choose to serve the country is a patriot, not hero. The term hero must be reserved for those that do heroic acts. Otherwise, it becomes a meaningless label. Someone needs to publicly ask McCain if he thinks he's a hero for being a former POW. He would, of course, say no, knowing he couldn't praise himself in such a way. Then we could use his own words to correct others that would try to honor him in such a way. As a former Marine and former Army officer, I can tell you that U.S. military personnel are not encouraged to become POWs. In fact, if you become a POW, something went wrong. You made a personal mistake that led to your capture, you didn't successfully evade capture, or you were just a victim of circumstances beyond your control. None of those events qualify you as a hero. The fact is, other than his experience as a POW, John McCain had an elitist military experience. His father was an admiral, and his grandfather was an admiral, and rather than entering boot camp and working his way up the ranks from enlisted to officer, John got a comfortable seat in the Naval Academy, where he was treated as an officer and a gentleman, and graduated near the bottom of his class. Nonetheless, in spite of his poor academic showing, the Admiral's son was allowed to become an aviator and entrusted to fly a multi-million-dollar aircraft, a privilege I suspect not normally extended to other Naval Academy cadets graduating at the bottom of their class. Mr. McCain also likes to often speak of his experience of, quote, commanding the largest squadron in the Navy, end quote. Anyone familiar with the military knows that a squadron is the smallest aviation unit in the Navy. It really isn't much of an accomplishment for a Naval Academy grad who is generally expected to go on to command larger units such as an aviation group or an aviation wing. In summary, Mr. McCain is certainly no hero as a result of his POW experience, and his military record can only be described as average at best. Chuck Roberts, San Marcos, California. Chuck, thank you for that very insightful letter. I completely agree. I think you're right on the money. I think we have dumbed down the word hero. I will, sometime in the second hour of the program today, I don't have time to go into it right at the moment, I should have scheduled it better, I want to talk to you about hero. I want to talk to you about, from somebody from my hometown, who I know was a hero. And if I can find that information here real quick, I will I will get it to you. Primaries today, North Carolina, Indiana. What's going to happen there? Well, as we think, Hillary Clinton will probably most likely win Indiana by 5 or 6, 7, 8 points, and most likely lose in North Carolina by the same amount. There really won't be any big switch in the difference of the pledged delegates. Probably not a big switch taking place even among superdelegates. I suspect many of them will remain uncommitted. Next stop after this one, we've got the West Virginia primary coming up on May 13th. That's a week from today. I got 28 delegates in West Virginia. Don't forget, Junior Bush won West Virginia with 56% in the last presidential election, although I suspect that's going to turn around this coming election. Kentucky, there's 51 delegates at stake in Kentucky coming up on May the 20th. That's 2 weeks from today, yeah. George Bush won that state with 60% in the presidential election, and that'll probably be a state that stays in the Republican column. And then we have Oregon also on May the 20th with 52 delegates. John McCain's won Oregon in a squeaker last time around. And then on June 1st, we've got Puerto Rico. I think they've got 55 delegates. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. And, of course, they don't vote, have electoral votes for president in Puerto Rico. And then Montana on June 3rd, 16 delegates there. Bush will win that state. Eric Bush. See, I can't get over that. It's stuck in my brain. You talk about McCain, I'm thinking Bush. Bush, McCain, what's the difference? There isn't any difference. Who'd I hear the other day? One of the Republicans say, good luck. It was that little idiot senator from South Carolina. What's his name? Can't think of it. It's just a little slob. From South Carolina. Shouldn't talk about a United States senator that way, should I? Anyway, he said, good luck trying to tie Bush to McCain. Well, good luck not, friend. Bush won Montana, anyway, with 59% in the last election, and probably stay that way. And same way in South Dakota. They've got 15 delegates, a highly popular state up in South Dakota. And Bush won that one with 60% in the last election. So I think most of those states will remain red, although West Virginia should turn this time, and Oregon will probably go with the Democratic candidate this time around. We shall see. So we've got some more to go. I think after today, the race will not be over. Lindsey Graham, thank you. You can always count on ELO for being the other part of my memory. I just can't come up with a name sometime. But yeah, Lindsey Graham, little dweeb from South Carolina. Haven't used that word for a while, dweeb. I think that's something we use in college, that word, dweeb. I want to talk a little bit in the second segment of the story today, too, after the news coming up, about these suspicious break-ins and this mess that went on with Siegelman, and just some very odd things taking place. Break-ins into governmental offices, break-ins into attorneys for former Governor Siegelman. Lots of very, very, very strange things happening, and it does make one wonder, especially since we know what kind of people we have in power in the White House. You remember G. Gordon Liddy and that sort of thing. Well, do I think that there's another group like that? I most certainly do. They'll probably be more careful this time, I should say. I would think they'd be a little more careful this time. Well, you're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We're going to pause for news at the top of the hour, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Canadian auto workers have approved a new 3-year contract with Ford Motor Company, avoiding a 2-tier wage structure. Jesse Russell reports.
The new contract negotiated between the workers represented by the Canadian Auto Workers Union and Ford Motor Company avoids the 2-tier wage model agreed on last year by the United Auto Workers. Under the 2-tier structure, new hires wouldn't benefit from the same pay rates as senior workers. Instead, the Canadian workers gave up a week of vacation and agreed to a wage freeze. The CAW now moves on to negotiations with Chrysler and MGM. The union hopes to use the Ford contract as a model for negotiations with those two companies.
The UAW in the U.S. has gone on a local strike, shutting down a Fairfax, Kansas GM plant. ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, is conducting a voter outreach program that will reach 2.8 million low- and moderate-income voters this year. Tony McElroy is ACORN's Texas state chair.
We are targeting African-American, Latino, new immigrants, and other underrepresented groups to make sure that we register them to vote, to get out and vote, and we keep them engaged in the process.
ACORN's goal is to register and mobilize voters who will then support candidates sensitive to the needs of low- and moderate income workers. An immigrant coalition called the Transnational Institute for Grassroots Research and Action says it has a deal with Virtual Money Incorporated to provide money transfer services for migrant workers. The deal ensures fair pricing, responsible investing, and genuine community reinvestment, according to the group. The coalition had launched an international boycott against Western Union, alleging unfair corporate practices. The coalition is demanding that Western Union cut its fees, provide what the group considers a fair exchange rate, commit a dollar from every transaction to a transnational community reinvestment fund, and adopt human rights screens in its investment practices. A 19-day strike at Chile's state-run copper producers sent copper prices to a new record during the past month. That strike ended Monday with what the Confederation of Contract Workers is calling a big victory. The Chilean workers went on strike for bonuses and increased benefits. The contract workers walked off the job at mines across the South American country. They blocked roads and tried to prevent buses from getting through that were carrying non-contract employees to the mines. Now here's Jesse Russell with WIN's Economic Report.
Services were up for the first time since December and April. According to the Institute for Supply Management, the index for non-manufacturing businesses crept up to 52. Economists consider anything above 50 to be positive, and in March, the number was at 49.6. Service sector employers added 90,000 jobs in April, while the billing sector saw a loss of 61,000.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey, John, I just heard you got a new computer. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's the coolest thing.
What will you do with your old computer?
I don't know. I guess I'll just throw it away.
Well, my company just bought new computers, and we decided to donate the old PCs to a place that gives them to local schools. You could do something like that.
Seriously, who would want a 3-year-old computer?
Hey, it might be great for someone else. Computers can be refurbished and reused instead of ending up in the trash. By passing it on, you can help the community and the environment.
If you're replacing your company's IT equipment or you're finished using your personal computer, pass it on to a local organization that accepts computers. To learn more, log on to epa.gov/passiton. This message was brought to you by EPA, Dell, Intel, HP, NEC, Philips, and this radio station on behalf of EPA's Plug Into eCycling Partnership. EPA does not endorse any commercial services or products of these groups. For information on all partners, log on to epa.gov/plugin.
James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Live!
This is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
Get countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. Yes, this is a political talk show. I am a liberal Democrat. Damn proud of that. Have no plans to change, have never been anything but. I am a yellow dog Democrat. And so there you have it. If you are a flaming conservative, neocon, you might want to switch to something else right now. You're going to think I've got a horns and a tail by the time the day is over with if you listen to what I have to say about your party and you folks. Because as my listeners know, I don't have a whole hell of a lot of good to say about the Republican Party these days. I don't have anything good to say about the neocons that are running it, and I have even less to say about that clan of thieves and liars that are running the White House and obviously the Pentagon right now. So I just wanted to warn everybody. That's my warning. If you're a neocon, flip over and listen to something else. Flip over and listen to Sean Hannity. 3 hours a day, that's all I ask of pure bullshit propaganda. If that's, that's what you want to hear, head on over there. You'll get all the propaganda. You can swallow it, and swallow it you will. Because obviously that kind of squill is exactly what people like you like. You want to be force-fed crap every single day. Because if you're an aficionado of the Hannity show, of the Hugh Hewitt show, of the drug-addled Limbaugh show, of all of those shows, if you're the kind of that love those, Mike Gallagher and, Neil Bortz, and we can go on, Mark Levin, who else? That crazy one out in California, Savage. If you're the one that loves to listen to those programs every day, let's face it, you're someone that cannot think for themselves, that does not want to think for themselves. It just delights in being spoon-fed your information so you can go to work and spread it to all your friends. Do you realize how stupid you look when you do that? Do you realize that someone like me and my listeners, that when you, and we live for that moment, that when you come up and give us some of that crap that we know that you've heard on the Rush Limbaugh the day before, and I know a guy like this who he did spit that out to me. He learned his lesson after a time. But when you come and spew that kind of stuff that we know you heard the day before, that Limbaugh did your thinking. I mean, think about this. Rush Limbaugh. You're getting your political opinions from Rush Limbaugh. I love it. I do. We were talking about we were talking before we went to the break about Hero and our good friend out in California sending us that terrific letter about what a hero is nowadays and how that term has been dumbed down, and I heartily agree. Chuck Roberts sent us that letter. It has been dumbed down. I know a family. Don't know, just know of them. I know these folks. And outside of the little town, I'm a country boy, but the county seat, outside of that little town, there was sign and still exists today, I'm sure. Proudly announcing that it was the home of a Medal of Honor winner. All four corners of the town had to sign because they were proud of him. His family was awarded posthumously the Medal of Honor for gallantry at the cost of his life on Iwo Jima, 26th of March, 1945. And let me just tell you what a real hero is. Let me just tell you what this man did to win the Congressional Medal of Honor posthumously awarded to his parents. First Lieutenant Harry Lynn Martin. This is the definition of a genuine hero. Let me just find the spot here when it tells what he did. For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life, above and beyond the call of duty as platoon leader attached to the Company 5th Pioneer Battalion, 5th Marine Division, in action against enemy Japanese forces on Iwo Jima Volcano Islands, 26th of March, 1945. With his sector of the 5th Pioneer Battalion bivouac area penetrated by a concentrated enemy attack launched a few minutes before dawn, First Lieutenant Martin instantly organized a firing line with the Marines nearest his foxhole and succeeded in checking momentarily the headlong rush of the Japanese. Determined to rescue several of his men trapped in positions overrun by the enemy, he defied intense hostile fire to work his way through the Japanese to the surrounding Marines, and although sustaining two severe wounds, he blasted the Japanese who attempted to intercept him, located his beleaguered men, and directed them to their own lines. When four of the infiltrating enemy took possession of an abandoned machine gun pit and subjected his sector to a barrage of hand grenades, First Lieutenant Martin alone, and armed only with a pistol, boldly charged the hostile position and killed all of its occupants. Realizing that his few remaining comrades could not repulse another organized attack, he called to his men to follow and then charged into the midst of the strong enemy force, firing his weapon and scattering them until he fell, mortally wounded by a grenade. By his outstanding valor, indomitable fighting spirit, and tenacious determination in the face of overwhelming odds, First Lieutenant Martin permanently disrupted a coordinated Japanese attack and prevented a greater loss of life in his own and adjacent platoons. His inspiring leadership and unswerving devotion to duty reflect the highest credit upon himself and the U.S. Naval Service. He gallantly gave his life in the service of his country. That, my friends, is the definition of a hero. Do not include John McCain in with people like that. That would be a mistake. I will honor the man for his service. I will honor the man for performing his duty, but do not call him a hero when compared to the likes of a Sergeant York, an Audie Murphy, or a man like First Lieutenant Harry Lynn Martin. That is the definition of a genuine hero. You can rewrite history all you want to. John McCain, for all he went through during the Vietnam War, is not the definition of a hero. I would submit to you that First Lieutenant Harry Lynn Martin was everything that embodies the name hero. So, let's stop this. Let's stop this right now. Let's not let them get away with running him as a war hero, putting him up on that platform when he does not deserve to be called a hero. I'm sorry. What he went through does not call for him to be called a hero. Patriotic? Yes. Doing his duty? Yes. Answering the call of his country? Yes. Hero? No. And he will run his presidential campaign on it because that is all that he has to run on. Do not forget that this man was part of the Keating Five. You hear the word hero come up about John McCain in today's media environment. Oh, they love John McCain. Hero, hero, hero. How many times have you heard him talk about the Keating Five lately? How many? I haven't heard it at all. You will hear it on this program often. You will hear it until you get tired of hearing about it. John McCain, Republican hero, voted against extending education benefits to the veterans of the Bush occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. John McCain voted against this. How could somebody who's a true military man, who truly loves the military, who served admirably in the military, and should be acutely aware of what military people go through. Oh, John McCain didn't have to have his college paid for. Now did he when he got out? He didn't have to have a GI Bill to pay for his education. He already had it paid for. He had the nomination to the Naval Academy because of his heritage. In no way did he deserve to go to the Naval Academy, but that's the way it goes. He got to go there because of his heritage. When you got a daddy and a granddaddy there, an admiral, and you want to get in the Naval Academy, you're getting in. But instead of have empathy for these men coming home from the Iraq occupation and the Afghanistan war, and allowing them to go to school on the taxpayer, which they sure as hell didn't. Well, they should have it. They deserve it. Everybody coming home from the Second World War could go to school on the GI Bill. There's no reason why these people can't either. John McCain voted against it. Voted against it. And he's a military man, supposedly. I'm sorry. I get carried away with this, and I don't apologize for talking this way about John McCain. I don't apologize at all. I am sick to death that here we are in the middle of a presidential campaign, and I moan and groan about the economy along with the best of them. I do. I complain about the price of groceries, the price of gas, the loss of jobs, and this economy that absolutely sucks. I complain about it every single day. But I do not forget what is going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. Somebody sent me a story to let me know that there was an anti-war rally in Pittsburgh yesterday. An anti-war rally. Three people showed up. Three. In a major metropolitan area, an anti-war rally, three people showed up. And all the while in Iraq, we got suicide bombers killing people left and right. We've got more of our troops getting killed in Baghdad. We've got Sunni leaders now coming from Anbar province who General Petraeus told us that where General Petraeus told us it was so safe, Anbar province, to stand shoulder to shoulder with Shiites to show some sort of solidarity against the U.S. in Sadr City. And about 3,500 of the 30,000 additional American troops sent in last year as part of this surge are getting ready to come home. And we have a leading U.S. general telling us, well, this drawdown, this continued drawdown of the surge brigades demonstrates continued progress in Iran, in Iraq. Really? And we're all moaning and groaning about the economy, and these people are coming home without arms and legs, a lot of them, coming home in boxes, flag-draped coffins. And we're more concerned with the economy. The economy is now the number one issue in this election. We don't hear either of the candidates on the left hardly talking about it at all. We're more concerned about 18.4 cents a gallon of federal gas tax, Hillary Clinton is. Barack Obama is more concerned about this and that. They're not talking about the war at all. Why? Because they... The National Institute of Mental Health predicts that the number of suicides among veterans of war in Iraq and Afghanistan may exceed the combat death toll because the Veterans Administration has inadequate mental health care. Think about that. The number of suicides among veterans of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan may exceed the combat death toll. And this isn't something that's on the air 24/7? This is criminal. We've got our candidates out talking about the gas tax holiday and saying almost nothing about this war that keeps getting crazier every single day. Eating up our money. Killing our youngsters. And we're concerned more about the price of gas than that, than anything. Makes me ashamed. Yes, the price of gasoline affects us all. Yes, the bad economy affects most of us who are not in that upper echelon of economic folks well off. But we need to push this ghastly Bush occupation of Iraq to the top of the concerns that Americans have in this election. It isn't like the Second World War when death visited every other home up and down your street, where everybody went and worked at a military job of some kind. We had this tremendous war effort and the entire country was behind it. It isn't like that now. Death does not visit the door in every community in America. Doesn't mean we should forget the people who it does visit. And it is shameful. And it is disgusting. And it makes me extremely angry when I look and see that the price of milk, gas, and groceries is the number one issue. I know that's important. I know it is. It affects us all. But this horrible, mistaken military adventure, selfish military adventure of George W. Bush ought to concern us more. Let's get that over with. We need to get it over with. 68% won our troops home safely in 6 months. 68% of the American people won our troops home within 6 months. Bush is asking for another $100 billion in Iraq. $100 billion more. Back in September of last year, only 54% wanted everybody home. Now it's up 14% more. There's no reason on this earth why they can't use the existing funds they have now to bring the troops home safely. No reason at all. Democratic support for bringing them home has grown by 15% since September. Independent support for bringing them home has grown by 20% since September. And, of course, as one might guess, Republican support for bringing them home is unchanged. Unchanged. You tell me which party deserves to occupy the White House. You tell me who's misguided in this country. That's a horrible statement about the Republican Party right there. There's been no change in their support for bringing the troops home since last September. No change. What the hell is wrong with these people? Especially when we see all this political progress going on in Iraq. What a big surprise. Got a report from UPI that the Iraqi government has turned down all of the Sunni Iraqi Accordant Front candidates for the ministries because they're unqualified. And you know what that means for Maliki and the Shiites who run Iraq? Sunnis are unqualified. Mm-hmm. Pretty clear what's going on there, isn't it? Political stability? Not in your lifetime. It's become apparent that we can't do a whole lot about it. Time to leave, folks. Time to leave. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to try and get a hold of Helen and be back in just a couple of minutes, so stay tuned. You'll want to hear from Helen Thomas. I know you will. With you here on the Guy James Show. Welcome back, everybody. Glad to have you along with us here this afternoon. And as promised, without further ado, we'll get right to it. The lady that you all have been waiting to hear from today, we have the best reporter in Washington with us. We have Helen Thomas. Helen, thank you so much for being on the program today.
I'm not the best reporter. Far from it.
Well, if we'd take a vote amongst my listeners right now, I think you'd find out otherwise.
I just the most outrageous.
The most tenacious. You're the one that digs for the truth a little harder than everybody else, I think, and we definitely applaud you for that. And what I wanted to talk to you about mainly, Helen, in your many years of sitting in the pressers there in Washington, seldom has anything come up that is more disgraceful than the story about the torture.
Right.
And I know recently, and maybe later on in the program I'll play it. I was going to play it a little earlier. I have the conversation between you and Ms. Perino, but it's outrageous to me that you're the only one in that room talking about the torture and really what was tacitly, if not explicitly, admitted by the Bush administration. Wasn't it pretty much admitted, in your opinion?
What astounds me is, see, every reporter goes in with their own question, and you don't expect others to support you. You stand alone. But every reporter in that room, and many more, have heard the President of the United States and his spokespeople represented at the podium year after year, I mean several years. We do not torture. In fact, earlier this year at two consecutive news conferences, the President of the United States said, we do not torture. Then he gave an interview to Martha Raddatz of ABC TV, and he said he knew all about the planning sessions for torture, and he approved it. Not one word from my colleagues. And it doesn't matter, you know. I am not in a position to criticize them, but I'm just astounded that they accepted so blithely after we heard so often, we do not torture. And then he said, yes, he gave an okay.
And it was this...
Not that I ever doubted it.
Well, I don't think any of us doubted it.
It from the horse's mouth was a little, you know, it seemed to me that everybody should have said, well, why have you denied it so long?
Well, Helen, as we all know, you were some time ago in this Bush administration, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of banished to the back of the bus for a while for asking questions that were uncomfortable. Is that it? I mean, I know you said you don't want to criticize, but what's the hesitancy of the other people to ask these sorts of questions?
Never underestimate the fear card. And never underestimate the fear that's in newspaper business today of challenging. 9/11 cowed everybody. And, you know, reporters were afraid to be called unpatriotic and un-American if they asked tough questions. But they defaulted on their jobs, and they let the country down.
Is it a fear of losing access to the White House and access to the presser?
I can't believe that access alone. I think that a lot of their probably corporate heads don't want them to rock the boat. The New York, shareholders or whatever they are, I don't know what the control is. All I know is that it's more of a matter of self-censorship, which is astounding for any reporter. Our job is to search for the truth. I know that puts a halo around it, but it's really true.
Well, it's what we count on you for. We, the public, we don't have any choice in many cases. I mean, yes, the Internet's come along and all that now, but we still depend on you folks who are there to get the truth out.
They have so co-opted the truth, you know. These hired guns, the generals who are briefed at the Pentagon to propagandize a war and not to really analyze it truthfully. We're dropping bombs every day on Sardar City. These are in Iraqis, so-called insurgents, meaning they're rebelling against our occupation. We drop them in homes and kill pregnant women. The New York Times today has a pregnant woman with two little children. They dropped a missile in her home. She burned to death. Where are the American people?
Well, that's the sad part about it. I'm just reporting on a story that there was an anti-war protest in Pittsburgh yesterday, and three people showed up. Where indeed are the American people? And I would maintain that part of it is because the media is not doing a good enough job.
There is a fear in the country of being ostracized if you don't play ball.
Helen, how come you've never got caught up in that? How come you're always the one that's right there and asking the tough questions and somehow seem to get away with it?
Got nothing to lose.
Nothing to lose. You've been in that room longer than anybody, right?
It isn't just that. It's just that, you know, you go for broke. You have. It's a great privilege to be there and to ask the questions. And if you let the country down, then you let yourself down.
Well, I think because of your fearlessness in asking questions and not having anything to lose, that's why you're probably held in such high esteem by people around the country. It certainly is something with me. I depend on people like you to ask the questions. Tell me, like with most
Can
recently...
Can I ask one little footnote?
Yes.
It shouldn't take courage.
Well,
I mean, that's our job.
Yes, I agree.
But go on. I interrupted you.
Well, no, but I think nowadays it appears it does take courage. It shouldn't. You should have open access and be able to ask anything you want. But we've had Tony Snow before Ms. Perino, and we got Ms. Perino in there right now. Do they ever display? Well, I noticed some harsh looks once in a while from Ms. Perino when you ask a question, a little bit of contemptuousness. Do you feel that in that room?
Of course. And not only that, probably in the viewing audience, they say, what is she? But I know, I think my colleagues think I'm off the wall, probably.
Well,
I don't think I'm a straight shooter. I think I'm laying it on the line.
Well,
why are we killing people?
Well, you have every right and every reason to ask that, and I should understand. Is there a different set of ethics with the younger crowd in that room than there is with you?
Hell yes. I mean, no, anybody who's been through the Vietnam and been through Korea and knows what World War II was all about, knows what the Germans, I mean, knows what the Europeans went through, knows about the Nazis, knows about Nuremberg. How on earth could we tolerate that we do things like that?
Well, it's a shameful chapter in American history.
There is a difference in reaction from Vietnam. At least the people were aroused. Once they knew the truth, they hit the streets. And they were appalled. They could not, actually, they deposed Johnson, and they went after Nixon. They could not continue this stuff.
Helen,
they have a reason to go to war.
Sure. How many presidents have you covered now?
Only nine.
Only nine. Well, counting backwards, that's Junior Bush, that's Clinton, that's Senior Bush, that's Ron Reagan, that's...
Mm-hmm.
Carter, that's
mm-hmm.
Jerry Ford, that's Nixon.
Mm-hmm. Goes back to Kennedy.
Johnson and Kennedy. You first started in that room with John Kennedy?
Right.
Oh, my. Oh, my. That's
the golden era by comparison.
Yes, yes. Is anybody, what year did they start doing the pressers the way they do them now? Do you know?
Well, live television was 61. When Kennedy came in, he was the one to institute television, live television. Eisenhower had tapings of his news conferences. But up to then, you know, the American people became really interested in news conferences, I think, with Kennedy.
Have you found an administration more difficult to work with than the one we have right now?
It's the most secretive. And secretive administrations, you know, when you really are seeking information, that's your job. It is more difficult, and they have a priority on information. They think that it's their private preserve. It's very hard unless they dole it out to their friends and finally tell you the truth. Yes, we torture.
Other than being in that room for the pressers, do you have the opportunity to speak with any of these people, access to call them and ask them about why they've done this and why they've done that?
Well, I think they're all on the same page. I must say that maybe I've been remiss in not pushing them, but they consider me the enfant terrible, so I don't want to push my luck.
I see. Well, you're with Hearst now, right?
Yes.
And how long have you been with Hearst?
Since 2000.
2000. Oh, my. What a career you've had, Helen. I just wanted to take a moment and thank you so much. Our listeners hold you in very high esteem, and I wanted to hear from you about this torture talk that's going on. Do you?
Well, it's just that the president finally told the truth.
Yes. And do you?
And then the reporters just were silent. They didn't say, hey, how come you haven't told us? Well, how come you've not said you have denied it for so many years?
Do you think
it's been in this war 5 years?
Oh, certainly. I mean, and if somebody would have told us that we would have government sanctioned at the highest levels, torture taking place by the United States of America, if you'd have told me that when I was growing up in this country that was the biggest, the best, and the most moral, we thought, I would have said, not a chance, and here we are looking at it.
And it's a turnaround that's taken so blithely, like ho-hum, oh well. Now,
yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and some of them almost brag about it. Yeah, well, we'll show them. We'll torture them.
Now they've told the truth, and, you know, it's not a bombshell. It's a feather drop.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, will there be any consequences? I can't see that there will.
I don't know where the conscience is.
Yeah.
I think that it's up to every individual to know we are responsible for everybody who is whipped and waterboarded, and that's us.
Yes. Yeah, it's in our name, and
exactly.
It's a crime against humanity and against the people of the United States as well. Helen, thanks so much for being on the program today. It's an honor.
I'm surprised you put a wild liberal on.
Oh well, I'm I'm a yellow dog Democrat liberal myself. So from one to another, Helen, it's wonderful to hear from you again, and we hope to talk to you again in the future. Keep up the wonderful work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, the inimitable Helen Thomas. What a wonderful lady she is. I've met with her in D.C. a couple of times and had a chance to talk with her at length, and she's really something, because on the one hand, she's a pit bull, and the other hand, she's one of the most lovable, nicest people you ever want to see in your life. And it's just something to see how she's able to blend the two when she needs to. She's the most honest, forthright person that we've had in the press in this country over the last 50 years, I'm sure. And I'm very proud to have an association with Ellen, and we hope to have her on again very, very soon. She's a treat. She really is. Always a treat to talk to her. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We'll take a short break and be back with you. You can call the program, 866-546-5254. Welcome back to the Guy James Show. Always nice to talk to Helen Thomas, the grand dame of reporting in Washington, D.C., the very best. Helen's been around a long time. Just think about that. first started in the Kennedy administration and has been there with all those nine presidents since then. Oh, how remarkable. I have a little bit of envy there. I do. Let's listen to that little segment she had with Dana Perino here a moment, about 2 weeks ago? Here it is.
Trump has said publicly several times in two consecutive news conferences a few months ago, and you have said it over and over again, we do not torture. Now he has admitted that he did sign off on torture, he didn't know about it. So how do you reconcile this credibility gap?
Well, you're taking liberties with what the president said. The United States has not, is not, torturing any detainees in a global war on terror. And General Hayden, amongst others, have spoken on Capitol Hill fully in this regard, and it is, I'll leave it where it is, when the president is accurate in saying what he said.
It's not my question. My question is, why did he say publicly we do not torture?
Because
when he really did know that we do.
No, that's what I mean, Helen. We've talked about the legal authorities.
That we did not.
I'm saying we did not. Yes.
How can you when you have photographs and everything else? I mean, how can you say that when he admits that he knew about it?
Helen, I think that you're conflating some issues, and you're misconstruing what the president said.
This country.
And what I'm telling you is, we have torture has not occurred. And you can go back through all the public record, and just make sure to, I would just respectfully ask you not to misconstrue what the president said.
In that we torture, and
yes,
we have tortured?
I am denying that.
So he's denying that. Now, the president of the United States has openly admitted that we've waterboarded at least three people. And according to the Geneva Convention, waterboarding is considered torture. According to Army regulations, our own Army regulations, waterboarding is considered torture. And yet we have a Department of Defense secretary who really doesn't know if it's torture. And we have Cheney and Bush and all the people in the White House playing little games. Little semantic games with whether it's torture or not. Hey, anybody knows that waterboarding is torture, period. Waterboarding is torture. If you don't believe it is, then you're ignorant or you're a fool, one or the other, or both. If you don't think it's torture. Now, if whether or not you think that something we ought to do or not, if it's something that you think that should be licensed by the United States government in the name of us, that's another story. If you're depraved enough, if you're immoral enough, if you're willing to put our own soldiers at risk by saying waterboarding is not torture, and if it's not torture that we, you know, if you think that we should do torture, it puts our own people, military people, at risk, then that's your cross to bear. But let's not play games with what torture is. Like I said, it's one thing if you think whether or not we should participate in torture. It's quite another thing to play these little semantic games on what torture is. Because any rational person knows that waterboarding is torture. And we also know that up till now, up until this horrible, illegal, immoral administration of Junior Bush, up to this point in history, America has prided itself as at least not officially being involved in any torture. But now we're officially involved in it. It's been sanctioned by the highest office in the land. It's been admitted to by the President of the United States that he sanctioned this. Call it what you will. How could any decent man sanction this in the name of the American people? Not in my name. And why there hasn't been more hell raised over this, I don't know. I'm ashamed that there hasn't been. And we start talking about terrible things that have taken place in this administration. We know that they sanction torture. We know that they think waterboarding is okay. We know that they think outing a CIA agent is just fine and bragging about it. We know all of that. We know they would commit how many thousand, hundred thousand soldiers to an illegal occupation of another country. We know they will do that. There have been untold illegalities that we know of committed by this administration, of which 27% of the American people still think they're doing a good job. Which leads me to the story that I've been wanting to talk about today. And it comes off a raw story, and I would encourage you all to go over and read it. Larissa's done a good job on this. In two states where U.S. attorneys are already under fire for serious allegations of political prosecutions, several people associated with three federal cases have experienced 10 suspicious incidents, including break-ins and arson. These crimes raise serious questions about possible use of deliberate intimidation tactics, not only because of who the victims are and the already wide criticism of the prosecutions to begin with, but also because of the suspicious nature of each incident individually as well as the pattern collectively. Typically, burglars do not break into an office or private residence only to rummage through documents, for example, as is the case with most of the burglaries in these two federal cases. In Alabama, for instance, the home of former Democratic Governor Don Siegelman was burglarized twice during the period of his first indictment. Nothing of value was taken, however, and according to the Siegelman family, the only items of interest to the burglars were the files in Siegelman's home office. Siegelman's attorney experienced the same type of break-in at her office. And in neighboring Mississippi, a case brought against a trial lawyer and three judges raises even more disturbing questions. Of the four individuals in the same case, three of the U.S. attorney's targets were the victims of crimes during their indictment or trial. This case, like that of Governor Siegelman, has been widely criticized as a politically motivated prosecution by a Bush U.S. attorney. The main target of the indictment, attorney Paul Miner, had his office broken into while Mississippi Supreme Court Justice Oliver Diaz Jr. had his home burglarized. And according to the police records and statements from Diaz and from individuals close to Miner, nothing of value was taken and the burglars only rummaged through documents. And in Miner's case, also took a single computer from an office full of expensive office equipment. The incidents are not limited to burglaries. In Mississippi, former Judge John Whitfield was the victim of arson at his office. In Alabama, the whistleblower in the Don Siegelman case, Dana Jill Simpson, had her home burned down. And shortly thereafter, her car was forced off the road. While there is no direct evidence linking these crimes to the U.S. Attorney's Office targeting these individuals, or to the Bush administration, there is a distinct pattern that makes it highly unlikely that these incidents are isolated and unrelated. All of these crimes remain unsolved. On February 21st, 2007, a private residence located at 1429 West Main Street in Rainesville, Alabama, caught fire. The house belonged to whistleblower Dana Jill Simpson, a longtime Alabama Republican lawyer and political opposition researcher who was then preparing to come forward in connection with the conviction of former Alabama Democratic Governor Don Siegelman and his co-defendant, Republican fundraiser and businessman Richard Skrushny. According to the police report obtained by Raw Story, the east side of the building was completely damaged and the entire structure sustained damages of roughly 30%. The cause of the fire was unknown. Doesn't it seem to you that all of this is a bit suspicious. I guess my question is, do you think it's possible that they are all related and they can all be traced to a certain group in Washington, D.C.? Former governor's private residence burglarized twice. His attorney's office burglarized. Computer comes up missing. Files come up missing. Mississippi Supreme Court justice's home broken into. Took nothing but files and computers and burglarized documents. What does that tell you? It raises red flags to me. I don't know about you, but it certainly does to me. Do I think there's a link? Well, I don't know. But given the propensity of this administration to perform illegal acts and have utter disregard for the law, and utter disregard for the people in the United States, except where it concerns their own profit and advancing their own motives, I wouldn't put it past them. I've said many times on this program that I would not put anything past this administration. And I emphasize the word anything. And I do mean anything. Have utter contempt for these people. And I guess the point of this conversation is not to overdo it about the Bush administration, because we'll be rid of them soon, but not soon enough. But what we must truly be rid of is the influence of this Republican neocon cabal that has taken over Washington during these last two or three decades. The stink of this has got to be washed out of Washington, D.C. It has to be done. It must be done for the good of this country. And one can only hope that the professor was correct last week, Professor Lichtman, when he said he thinks that, and I'm paraphrasing now, that this neocon movement is in its death throes, that we're seeing the end of it. We can only hope to God that that is the case. For the good of this country, that must be the case. And for the good of this country, we must see that as many of these people as we can possibly effect in this coming election must be swept out of office. You may not be entirely pleased with the Democratic Party, and I know we're not. But it's a start. Sweeping out the filth is a start. We may still end up with some dirty floors, but we may not end up knee-deep in mud like we are right now. So it remains for us to work hard to get that done. I think we can get it done. I think we will get it done. I have confidence. I hope. Well, it's a little late for a phone call now. I got one coming in, but I'm sorry we can't take it right now. We'll have to call back another time. Where have you guys been on the phone today? Very, very quiet group. Of course, we did have a couple of great interviews today with Glenn Greenwald. I want to thank him very much. Glenn of Salon Magazine, always a pleasure to talk to him. Great writer. Go to Salon and read his latest article. And the great Helen Thomas, always great to hear from her. And we'll have both of them back again soon. I talked to them over the weekend, and we'll have them back on, especially Glenn, to talk about his new book coming out. Well, it's been a pleasure being with us here on the show today. I do want to remind you and that this is a listener-supported program, and we certainly could use some assistance right now. I know everybody's having pledge drives and fund drives and all that, but we must. And to tell you the truth, it's not... not been terribly effective. So I hope you will take us seriously that we do need your support to keep the show going. And if we don't have enough support, we can't. So keep that in mind. I hope you will. And thanks to all of you that do contribute to the program. It's appreciated more than you know. I can't properly express my appreciation. Thanks for joining us here today.
America, welcome to the Inside Scoop. It was just a few months ago that a reporter raised the question of $4 a gallon gasoline to George Bush, and the president seemed genuinely surprised, shocked at the notion that gas prices could ever rise $4 a gallon. Today, that price is not at all unheard of, and the president last week was taken to sputtering, "I don't have a magic wand. I can't do anything. What do you think I am, president?" Well, he didn't quite say that, but he did say there was no magic wand and that basically it was helpless. He couldn't do anything about gas prices. But should anything be done about gas prices? After all, with the demand for gas, that just keeps us going into foreign countries in the Middle East and paying them trillions of dollars and staying in enormous debt. Clearly, America needs to get off its addiction to foreign oil. But that's the long-term solution. What's the short-term solution? Should we change the gas tax, for example? Should there be a windfall profits tax for oil companies? Are they profiting off our misfortune? How about refinery capacity? Is that the solution? And what should be the long-term answer? Jimmy Carter tried to help us in the 70s to get off our addiction to foreign oil, and then came the 80s and nothing happened. These are tough questions, and I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I sure hope my guest does. His name is Tyson Slocum. He is the director of the energy program at Public Citizen, which I should make clear is no longer affiliated with Ralph Nader. But more importantly, he was on this show just 3 years ago when we were complaining about the high gas prices. Then I think we were complaining about $2 a gallon. Now it's $4 a gallon, and he's scheduled to testify tomorrow before the House Transportation Committee. Tyson Slocum, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, great to be here.
What are you going to tell the House Transportation Committee tomorrow?
Well, they want to know why prices are spiking so high. And what I'm going to tell them is that the current levels of prices that we're seeing, around $115, $120 a barrel, are not justified by the supply-demand fundamentals. There are no global shortages of crude oil. I'm not talking about a conspiracy here. What it is under-regulation of the futures markets. Contrary to what most people think, the price of oil and gasoline is not set by OPEC. It's not set in Saudi Arabia. They try to influence the price with their decisions about how much to produce and how much to export. But the price is actually set every day in